accession number 32297, reel 9.
John Dixon, reel 9. So what was the next stage then?
Well, after that we tried this, and then I think they gave us a gun with some bullets in it, and they sent us up, and they had a target towing aircraft, which may have been a Lysander. I can't remember exactly, and this towed a target behind it, just like a banner. And the idea was that you fired your gun at this banner, and the bullets that you were given were tipped with a colour, whether it was paint or whatever, but so they could identify which was your shots, you see, by having these coloured tips bullets, and you fired away your gun at this target, this drogue. And then you came back all happy, making quite certain that before you came into the circuit you switched all the gunnery stuff off. You didn't want to inadvertently shoot somebody, which I believe did happen once or twice, but there we are. And then another chap would fire at the same target, but he had a different coloured bullets, and this would go on throughout the morning probably. And then eventually the target towing aircraft would come in, it would release its drogue over the airfield, and the idea then was everybody rushed out to get this drogue to see how many bullet holes there were in it with your colour on it. I think there was mortification because I don't think anybody ever found any. It was very hit and miss. But this was how we were supposed to be assessed whether we were going to be good fighter pilots or not. I think the truth of the matter really, Richard, was that the guns were not properly harmonised. I mean, they were just in the plane, but obviously to get them working they had to be harmonised with a sight and all this, that and the other. But it was great fun because you really felt you were being a hot pilot when you were actually firing a gun at something. I don't think anybody actually hit the target towing aircraft, but it was always a risk, of course. And of course there is a classic comet which never happened to us, of course, but when somebody was firing guns at a target towing aircraft, and he could see, because they were tracer ammunition, that they were shooting ahead, and the target towing aircraft said, "I'm towing this drogue, not pushing it." But I'm digressing. It didn't happen to us.
I was going to ask how easy it was to hit the target, but obviously from that, it wasn't that easy. Was it limited as well in the types of approaches you could make to an aircraft as well?
Well, we never got to that. I mean, this would have come, if you were going to be a fighter pilot, obviously this would have all come at a later stage in your training. I mean, basically, we were just taught the quarter attack, which just meant coming in. You didn't come directly behind the target tower, because that would have been a bit risky, wouldn't it? So you came in from the beam, or from just behind the beam, abaft the beam, sorry, we're Navy, aren't we? Just abaft the beam, and that was that. We then moved on and did the same thing, a camera gun and a fixed gun on ground targets. They had a great big target, I suppose rather like an archery target or something like that, stuck in the middle of some isolated field somewhere. At least I think it was well isolated. And we dived on that with our camera, and then we repeated that with a gun, and the idea was to try and hit this target. I can't remember whether we had any success at that either.
What was the suggested sort of angle of approach that you took to attack the target?
On the ground, or probably no more than about 30 degrees in the dive. We didn't do anything too dramatic, but that was it. But again, it was huge fun to actually fire a gun at something. I don't know, I maybe we did have a bit more success at that. And from there, And the thing I think that probably marked us out as to whether you were going to be a fighter pilot or a bomber pilot was when we had to do drop practice bombs on targets. They had a target set up somewhere, and you would dive over this or come down in a fairly shallow attack as if you were attacking a submarine, let's put it that way, and you'd have four practice bombs, each 11 and a half pounds if I remember, and you could drop them either singly or as a stick. And they would then, there would be range markers, people with like theodolite type things that would actually mark the fall of shot, because they were smoke bombs, and they could pinpoint exactly where each bomb had fallen in relation to the target. And when you'd done those sort of exercises, they would communicate the results back to your squadron, and they would tell you what your average error was, and I think you had to be within 20 yards to pass. Any average error over that, you were marked as a failure. And of course the better you got at it, the more likely you were to become a bomber pilot.
So at that stage, that was almost an element there where they were starting to select what type of role you would have.
We didn't know it at the time. We didn't know it, but all these things must have been kept on file somewhere, because you know, I think if you were going to opt to be a fighter pilot, they would have checked everything through your aerobatics, everything like that, and whether you'd had any success with your gunnery or that sort of thing. But otherwise, I suppose, you know, your bombing results were important.
You did formation flying at this time as
yes,
well.
Yes, yeah, well, that was the next thing.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, frightening at first, because, I mean, nobody likes to be too close to another aeroplane in the air. And it was very, you were a bit apprehensive about it, but you all started with an instructor. And normally what happened, two planes would take off, each with an instructor and a pupil, and you take it in turns, one to formate on the other. And your instructor would show you how to do it. He'd line you up in a roughly the right sort of position, and if he wanted you to edge in closer to the other aeroplane, which of course was normal because everybody tended to fly a bit far apart, he would show you that you edged in using rudder. You so that he sort of you sort of sidled in like this until he set you in the right position, which was probably with your wingtip about 3 feet away from his wingtip, slightly back. And then if you were getting too close and you needed to slip out, then you used a control column, so you banked the aircraft out. But you didn't bank the aircraft in for obvious reason. If you were banking it in and you got in the right position and then lifted the inside wing, you might even clobber the other chap. So it was always rudder in, stick out. That was the instruction. And then having got settled in the right sort of situation, you didn't really have to do very much except obviously watch like mad, and then adjust your throttle to make sure that you didn't sort of go too far ahead or too far back. And the other thing was, as you bank, if you bank like this, turning to the port, let's say you're turning port and you're on the outside, you are the formating aircraft on the outside, you would need a little bit more throttle to keep up. In other words, you were going to lag back. So it's just a question of judging in relation to the other plane. Having done all that, and of course you'd just switch over and he would formate on you. this is where you hoped that your good mate and chum was wasn't going to do anything too silly. So it sounded frightening, and it probably still does when you talk about it, but it became absolutely second nature. We never had any fatalities just through normal formation flying. We may have had some nasty incidents later on, but this was just normal formation flying.
Did it take a lot of concentration to keep in that position?
Oh, you had to concentrate. Absolutely, you couldn't let waver. I mean, I'm jumping ahead a bit now. If you ever, you wouldn't normally fly in formation into a cloud, not at this stage. But if you did, if you inadvertently flew into a cloud, you just had to stick with it. You didn't let wander off unless you completely lost it, of course. But you'd stick with it, so you could always see just enough to keep concentrating on your exact position relative to the plane you were formating on. And then eventually, towards the end of our time in Harvard's out there, of course the formations got a bit bigger, and we may have ended up with 3, 4 or even more of us all flying in formation.
Is that any more difficult than formating on just another aircraft, or do you just concentrate on that aircraft, say to your port?
Well, if you were one of the wingmen, you are only concerned with the chap that's on your side that you've got to formate on him. You're not concerned with anything else at all. If you were leading a sub flight or something in the behind, you are just concentrating on where you are in relation to the chap that's in front of you. You're not too worried about anything else. You just put your position right. And it's exactly the same today when you watch the Red Arrows. They are purely and simply lining themselves up with one plane, that they are concerned with. There we are. Again, I'm digressing, but whenever I watch the Red Arrows now and everybody says, isn't it marvellous? And I would often say, yes, but flying formation in a jet is a jolly sight easier than in a propeller-driven aircraft, because in a propeller-driven aircraft, every time you move the throttle setting, you have to change the trim of the aircraft, or you do if you're a competent pilot. So you've got a few more things to think about.
Did you get the opportunity while you were there to do law flying as well?
Yes, we did, officially or unofficially. We had to do a certain amount of low flying for you know, it was a very good training. And as far as we as naval pilots were concerned, it was very important to actually do low flying over the lakes and the sea, because low flying over the land is... Well, obviously you've got plenty of things to line yourself up and gauge your height, and you can see the hills and things around or whatever. But when you're flying over the sea, depending on the angle of the sun or the moon or whatever light, you get a very different impression of how high you are. And you've got to rely on your instruments, of course. And there are a number of instances where people have actually flown into the sea just because they haven't appreciated the light coming off the surface. And we learnt this quite early. We were given official low-flying instruction, obviously with an instructor to start with. And there were certain areas where you could do it and where you shouldn't do it and all this, that and the other. But when we were flying solo, and we were on our own, nobody did too much what you were doing, we used to all do it, I think, fly low, and I used to spend a lot of time whizzing up and down the lakes hoping not to disturb too many fishermen or whatever was out there. So there we are.
Is the sensation different, obviously, with low flying than flying?
Oh, very much so, because the higher up you are, the land doesn't seem to move. Well, you've been in an airliner, you look out of an airliner, nothing much seems to be happening, all those feet below. But when you're flying low, it's like driving a very fast car, and very exciting, very exciting. Yeah, go on. Well, later on, in my later flying, of course, we had radio altimeters, and they were wonderful, wonderful sensitive things. They would show you, they worked on radio waves that bounced back off the surface, and they were accurate to probably within 10 feet. And if you were flying over the sea, you could actually see the waves, because your needle of your altimeter would go up and down. Wonderful things. So, but we didn't have anything like that when we were on Harvards.
I take it as well, at that stage you would run cross countries as well.
Yeah, we did cross country flying. All in my logbook. Everybody always did the same route. Picton, Tweed, various towns that we flew to, which... Well, it was again very straightforward in Canada. Whether there was snow on the ground or not, if there was snow on the ground, the towns just stood out, little black blobs all over them. No problem finding them. If it wasn't snowy, well, it was straightforward, because the towns were fairly well spaced out. Very different flying in England over the Midlands, where it's one mass of houses and factories and things. So it was, you knew exactly where you were.
But you wouldn't use, because obviously you mentioned when you were using the Tiger Moth, it was generally railway lines that you would use. What would you use between the towns?
Well, there were roads, but there were railways as well. Not too many, not so many railways. But I think basically, I mean, if you knew you were here and you were going to, let's say, a place called Tweed, which you knew was at about 20 degrees, whatever, and you saw a town roughly in that direction, it had to be Tweed, because there wasn't going to be anything else. So it became quite easy. And if you went flying round north of the lake, north of Lake Ontario or wherever we were, over the interior, when you came back, if the weather was clear, you could see the lake from miles away. And Kingston stood on a little promontory, or a double promontory, and I think there was a big grain elevator not too far away. So you could see this for 20, 30 miles, so we never really got lost.
During this period, the transformation from, obviously, the elementary flying element that you'd done to go on to the more advanced Harvard, were there any of your sort of fellow pupils who didn't make that transformation and were scrubbed?
Oh, yes, yes. Oh, we were losing them all the way through. Not at any great rate of knots. But I suppose, you know, thinking back to the ones that started off at Elmden on Tiger Moss, and the ones that actually got their wings out at Kingston in December, I should think we probably lost, oh, I don't know, 20% maybe, for various reasons. One or two, I think, decided they didn't really like it. This was never talked about much, because, as you can imagine, if somebody left the course, they didn't sort of dwell and tell you how terrible it was or anything. A few, of course, were desperately disappointed, and they couldn't see why, but they were lacking in some skills.
So at that stage, they couldn't really... They'd been okay, say, on the Tiger Moth, which was quite a gentle aircraft, but you go to a more powerful one. Was it more of a different sensations that they didn't feel happy
Well,
with?
Probably that, or probably they were... It was obvious they were never going to be useful at... formation flying, put it that way. That could have ruined them, a few of them. Gunnery and the bombery, gunnery and bombing may have tripped a few of them up. I can't honestly think of any real one reason why they would have turned it down. But as I say, there may have been one or two that didn't want to carry on. And I had a course photograph somewhere of our group out there in Kingston, and I think there were. I used to put a cross above the heads of those that didn't make the course, and there were quite a few. And I would think, you know, we probably did lose, 10-20%.
Did you come across any of them later on in your career?
Not of those particular ones. I've got a particular chum now who went to train as a pilot in America in the Pensacola lot, and he just couldn't make it out there, and I sent him back to England, and he was lucky in that because he'd done very well on his ground school, they did let him retrain as an observer. And that was the best you could really hope for if you were turned down as a pilot. But I don't know what happened to the others. I'm sure it was quite a traumatic time. It's the last thing you ever wanted to happen to you, to be told that you were scrubbed out, finished. There was one chap. Well, there were a couple of reasons why you might slip back, of course. Obviously, if you had health problems, there were odd people who fell behind because they'd got a health problem, and they were then set back onto the following course. And there was one chap who was very marginal, and he was desperately keen, and they let him slip back, of course, and I think he eventually got his wings, you know, a month or so later.
Is there an element here as well when you're training to be a pilot that you get a feel for the aircraft, you get a feel for that? Does that develop over this part of the course?
Oh, of course,
really?
It does. It's bound to, isn't it? It's like, well, I'm sitting here looking at you. You drive your car. You know exactly how it works. But you don't sit in it every day and say, now I'll do this, now I'll do that, now I must press this, and now I must switch this. It's automatic, it's instinctive, like riding a bicycle, really, isn't it? You don't have to think. And the risk, of course, is, and this is where the training is so important, you can get overconfident. One or two people I know came to quite sticky ends because they were obviously overconfident. It's just a question of mental balance, I think, is probably the way.
Were there any accidents on your course? I mean, I know you mentioned obviously your taxiing incident, but I mean, I was thinking, were there more serious accidents that occurred?
I don't recollect any on my course. I think there were one or two that had happened at Gananoque, not when I was there, but you know, people had collided in the air at night or done something silly. There were a couple of other things that did come to mind. I do remember once at Kingston, everybody rushing out saying, oh, so-and-so can't get his undercarriage down or something, and he was going to do a belly landing, which of course was quite something to quite spectacular, and it was like a boxing match. Is somebody going to end up with a bloody nose, you know? But we watched all this because it was quite exciting. It happened to me much later on, but it was no big deal. But I could remember that, and oh, that was an exciting day to remember. The other thing that you talking about people getting scrubbed off the course, I've just remembered, just along the St Lawrence River, the St Lawrence Seaway from Kingston, was what was called the Thousand Islands Bridge. It was rather like the Sydney Harbour Bridge going across. It was the main bridge between the United States and Canada. And of course, we used to look at it and think, well, when we can fly under this bridge. We were told, when the minute we arrived, if anybody flies underneath that bridge, you will automatically be scrubbed off the course, you will not become pilots. And we looked at it and we thought, could we get away with it? Could we get away with it? Nobody on my course tried it. It had been done before. We know it had been done. People boast about having done it. And we do know that one or two people were chopped off the course because of it. So there we are, but that was another reason that you could...
You've also mentioned a little bit about the weather conditions. How did that affect the flying during that period?
Well, as I say, we were there, I think our flying was September to December, our 16 weeks. The last few weeks, of course, it was snowy, and we did get the odd blizzard. Obviously, you didn't fly in really blizzard conditions. But once it had stopped snowing, and once they'd compacted the snow onto the airfield and it was safe to fly, you flew. And of course the visibility then was absolutely superb, wonderful. It was a great joy to fly.
A contrast to the East Midlands, weather-wise?
Well, yes, I suppose so. Yes, very much so. Flying in the UK in the winter was very difficult, murky conditions. And this, again, digressing a little bit, our friends who were trained in Pensacola out in America never had to contend with any sort of weather. They never had to contend with flying over blacked-out Britain. And some of them, when they came back to the UK, they found it extremely difficult. And by and large, those people that were trained in America and came over to the UK, they didn't fly in squadrons that specialised in night flying. They were not normally just day flyers. And if you just think for a minute, compare the Royal Air Force and the American Air Force that operated from Britain, they were all daylight people. They weren't trained for night flying. And very few of them actually had to. So there we are.
So there's an advantage there almost, is the for flying, if you've trained in poorer conditions, really.
It taught you to be self-reliant, to rely on your instruments. I mean, this was the important thing, and we'd learnt those skills right from the beginning. So I think we were probably better equipped in some ways than our American friends, but perhaps they wouldn't like me to hear that. I'd like to hear that from me, I should say.
And how had you taken to the Harvard, obviously, throughout that period? Was it an aircraft that you liked?
Initially, no, because it was... Well, if I say it was a handful, of course, looking back on it, it was nothing like a handful. But compared with the Tiger Moth, it was a much more complicated aircraft. Vicious is too strong a word. It did have one nasty little habit, and that is when you landed it in the normal tail-down three-point attitude, if you didn't run straight, and if there was a bit of a crosswind or anything, it could easily do what we call a ground loop, whereby you lost control of it and the plane would sort of spin round on one wheel, you all looked a bit foolish and silly. Don't think it ever happened to me. No, I don't remember it, but it was something you had to be very, very aware of. In other words, I think, Richard, the best way I can describe it is you couldn't just get the plane on the ground and forget it. You didn't relax. You were concentrated until the plane came to a stop, because in that run-down period, it could suddenly do one of these ground loops if you got a little bit of wrong rudder on, or as I say, if there's a strong crosswind or something like that. You've got to be very careful.